From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. It is Super Tuesday, and 14 states are voting, including Utah, where Salt Lake City resident Willard Cron says he's all in for Senator Bernie Sanders.
I voted for him for the Medicare, for canceling student debt, for tipping the scales in favor of the working class.
Samantha Bartholomew supports former Vice President Joe Biden.
I didn't like everything Obama did, but I knew he was a good person. So if Biden was on his team, Biden's probably a good person too.
Sonia Hudson is politics reporter for KUER in Salt Lake City, where Senator Sanders held a rally yesterday. He easily won the state in the 2016 Democratic caucuses. Sonia, welcome.
Hi.
And so voting is underway in Utah. What have you noticed so far today?
Yeah, so here Bernie Sanders is kind of the favorite to win, but a lot of people are complaining about how all of these other candidates have dropped out that they maybe wanted to support. And it's kind of actually reignited this debate here about whether or not we should have ranked choice voting, which
really?
Is where you can rank your choices 1, 2, and 3. So if your preferred candidate drops out, you can still have a vote for someone else that you like.
So are you saying that you've noticed some fresh energy on the moderate side, like for a Joe Biden or a Michael Bloomberg? How are they doing in the state?
So there was actually a new poll that just came out a couple days ago that put Bloomberg at the top of the pile for the first time. All other polls up until now have put Sanders at the top by a pretty wide margin.
Huh.
And yeah, this poll by Swayable put Bloomberg at 29%, Biden at 27%, and Sanders at 22%.
That's Sonia Hudson. She's politics reporter for KUER in Salt Lake City. By the way, 29 delegates up for grabs in the Democratic primary today. Sonia, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, let's turn now to NPR political correspondent Asma Khalid, who is traveling with the Biden campaign. She joins us from a bus in Oakland, California. Hi, Asma.
That's right. Hi, Jeremy. And if it's a little noisy, that's why. We're currently en route to our next destination.
Okay. And I understand that Joe Biden is actually not on your bus, but maybe traveling in the same general vicinity. You were at the rally last night where Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg endorsed Biden. Buttigieg actually endorsed right before that rally, but both had quit their campaigns. You've been with Biden. What would a good day be for him today?
Well, I think we should just point out that those endorsements, in addition to an endorsement from former Congressman Beto O'Rourke, who had a pretty strong run for the Senate there in Texas, he also endorsed him last night. And that was sort of a monumental, I think, sort of coalescing around Biden. And specifically, I think what's worth pointing out, Jeremy, is that this is happening as a clear desire to present a primary alternative to Bernie Sanders. And I do wonder, you know, had Sanders not been doing as well as we're heading into Super Tuesday, would we have seen these candidates drop out and quickly unite around Joe Biden? In terms, though, of what, you know, a good day for him would be today, there is certainly a lot of momentum. He's had a really strong 72 hours. You feel that. You feel the enthusiasm when you're at his events. It's such a stark difference than what his events felt like, say, in Iowa or New Hampshire. He needs to stop Bernie Sanders from developing an insurmountable lead. And, you know, while the last 72 hours have been very good for him, it's worth pointing out that Bernie Sanders has had a lot of money and a lot of grassroots support and infrastructure in these 14 states that are voting today for a long time.
California is the biggest prize today where you are, but Bernie Sanders has been well ahead in the polls there. What is Biden doing to counter that, obviously spending some of today there on this crucial day?
Yep. So we're here in Oakland, and then we'll be going later today to Los Angeles. That's, in fact, where he's going to have his party this evening. You know, I think part of it is just it's a matter of trying to quickly play catch-up. They have certainly had a lot of a bump in fundraising, both because of his resounding victory in South Carolina, but then also the sort of quick coalescing of establishment support around him. So they have seen their fundraising numbers go up. They have already decided, you know, they can look forward into some of the states beyond Super Tuesday. But in terms of California and Bernie Sanders, yes, this is a really favorable state for him. Part of it is because of, you know, the infrastructure he has built up in this state. Part of it is also because of grassroots enthusiasm. You know, I've done some reporting on progressive groups. There was a lot of questioning back last summer that would progressive groups back Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders. We have seen them unite around Bernie Sanders pretty unanimously at this point. And to me, that is one of the strong strengths that Sanders has, because these groups are not just endorsing him. They are now knocking on doors for him. And they did a lot of this get out the vote effort in Nevada we're expecting to see a lot of that in some of these states where they're active today as well.
I think I might have heard a siren in the background there. Make sure they're keeping the speed where it should be, Asma, as you drive along
we're
the
all
bus.
Good.
Okay. What about Michael Bloomberg? He is finally on the ballot today. What does he need to do today to show that he can stay in this race?
Well, he needs to win some states, Jeremy. I mean, he got into this race because the theory of his case was that he needed to be here in case of a moderate collapse. I mean, that was, I think, sort of the subtext was that Joe Biden would potentially collapse. We're not seeing that happening. In fact, if anything, like I've said, Biden has had a sort of resurgence. And so with Bloomberg being in this race now, you know, his argument is that nobody has yet voted for him. Nobody has seen him on a ballot. That is true. But I think it becomes really hard to continue to make the case of electability and a moderate alternative if you're not actually winning states today.
Do you have a sense of where the campaign's going next after California?
So the race moves on to a number of states, you know, Michigan, I believe, Missouri, Mississippi. Joe Biden wants to specifically focus on states that where there is a sizable African-American mm-hmm. population. He seems to have a strength there, and I think that's what we'll see him doing in the next few days as well.
That is NPR political correspondent Asma Khalid joining us from a bus in or around Oakland, California. Asma, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Public health officials are also busy today working to stop the spread of the new coronavirus. There have been 6 deaths in the U.S., all of them so far in Washington state, where officials have declared a state of emergency. Dow Constantine is King County executive, the top elected official in King County, Washington, which includes Seattle. Dow, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And look, in many ways, you are at the epicenter of this outbreak as we know it now in the United States. There are some schools that are closed today in your area. What is the mood there where you are?
Well, you know, understandably, it's tense. We are working to both get people aligned around actions that could be taken and tamp down irrational fears. So I'm pleased with the progress so far, and of course, we have a long way to go.
As you know, the CDC recently changed the criteria for who should be tested and has given states more access to the testing kits to carry those tests out. What is the state of the testing in King County right now, and are you doing more than you had been in the last couple of days?
Yes, this week now, the testing is really ramping up. The state lab is going to be able to test a couple hundred or more people per day. The University of Washington is now going to be testing. So we're rapidly increasing the number of tests, and that is going to help us make sure that first responders are kept safe, that we're identifying cases early so that people can receive treatment.
And to that end, we see that King County is actually in the process of buying a motel so that it can become something of a hospital. How would that work?
Well, not a hospital, but a facility for isolation and recovery. This would be a place where if you are unable to go home because you don't want to infect your family, or if you're without a home, you can safely stay until you're no longer contagious. And we are setting up mobile facilities using manufactured housing units in several other locations. We're going to continue to increase this capacity to make sure that, again, we're doing everything possible to reduce the infection rate and give the medical community time to develop treatments and ultimately immunizations.
And who pays for those mobile housing units and also, I mean, the purchase of a hotel? Is the federal government helping you out?
Well, we, of course, are anxious for the federal government to help out. And I appreciate Senator Patty Murray from our state and our members of Congress who are working hard to make sure that federal funds are directed to local efforts. But we are moving money. I signed an emergency proclamation to allow me to move money from other purposes to help with this emergency situation. And we are not going to be slowed down waiting to figure out who's going to reimburse us for these items.
Next week, Seattle, and I'm sure you've been tracking this, has a big event, a Comic-Con event planned. Last year, almost 100,000 people came in from all over the country to attend this conference. Are you yet at the point where you think large events in King County, in the Seattle area, should be canceled?
We're relying on public health and medical professionals to tell us when that point might be. But we will, when the science tells us, we will suggest and, if necessary, order events to be canceled.
What else are you worried about today?
You know, the biggest concern that's kind of come to the fore is the fact that there's such a dramatic difference in the vulnerability of people to this virus. Many people may be carrying it, It is the elderly and those with compromised immune systems who are suffering the consequences. And so I want to emphasize to people who care for older adults or someone with a compromised immune system to keep them away from any unnecessary contact with anyone until we have a better idea of the shape of this crisis. And there will be treatments and vaccinations on the horizon. So the longer we can forestall the spread of this disease or of this virus, the better chance we all have of coming through this healthy.
That's Dow Constantine, King County Executive in Washington State. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
This message comes from Here and Now's sponsor, Indeed. Are you hiring? With Indeed, you can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on your short list of qualified candidates using an online dashboard. Get started today at Indeed.com/HereNow.
Chris Matthews, the political commentator and host of MSNBC's Hardball, opened his show last night by resigning from the post he'd held for decades.
Let me start with my headline tonight. I'm retiring. This is the last Hardball on MSNBC. And obviously, this isn't for lack of interest in politics. As you can tell, I've loved every minute of my 20 years as host of Hardball. Every morning I read the papers and I'm gung-ho to get to work. Not many people have had this privilege.
Matthews had faced criticism from the left for his coverage of the Democratic primary and from a woman who had accused him of sexual harassment. Let's bring in NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, who's in New York. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
So Matthews said he made the decision to announce his retirement last night after conversations with MSNBC. He is 74 years old, and he said the younger generation is out there ready to take the reins. He acknowledged inappropriate remarks he had made to women in the past. Listen to this.
Compliments on a woman's appearance that some men, including me, might have once incorrectly thought were okay. We're never okay. Not then and certainly not today. And for making such comments in the past, I'm sorry.
What incidents is he referring to there? And was he forced out?
Yeah, this wasn't a retirement. This was a resignation. And it was a resignation that basically was directed to him in conversations with MSNBC's president, Phil Griffin, a longtime friend and producer. The specific triggering act appears to have been a column by Laura Bassett, a journalist who was writing in GQ magazine. She had written several years ago as the Me Too movement really broke into the open in society about an anonymous cable host who had ogled her, who had sexually harassed her, who had said things that made her – he basically was like, I'm going to fall in love with you, according to her account. You know, make sure to wipe that makeup off, he said to the makeup artist working on her before an appearance on his show, because otherwise people fall in love with her. Why haven't I fallen in love with you already? She represented this as making her just think about her looks, essentially sexually harassing her before she went on his very program. Official at MSNBC confirms that was a big part of it, but there were a lot of other missteps over the years, and MSNBC has to acknowledge it has conceded previously that in 1999 it had a complaint of sexual harassment against Matthews for remarks he had made, and that it had, it said, rebuked him strongly. Played against that context, Matthews was basically gone.
He had also been under fire from the left in recent weeks, people calling for him to be fired over comments he made about the Democratic primary. Here he is comparing Bernie Sanders' victory in the Nevada caucuses to the Nazi occupation of France during World War II.
I'm reading last night about the fall of France in the summer of 1940, and the general, Renault, calls up Churchill and says, it's over. And Churchill says, how can it be? You got the greatest army in Europe. How can it be over? He said, it's over. So I had that suppressed feeling.
Okay, so he was making that comparison there. We should note that Matthews often makes historical comparisons, although not necessarily to Nazi Germany and Nazi-occupied France. Some also criticized this exchange he had with Elizabeth Warren after the debate in which she confronted Michael Bloomberg about a lawsuit that alleged he told a pregnant employee to kill the baby. Bloomberg denied having said that. Listen.
My question about him, you believe he's lying?
I believe the woman.
You believe he's
lying? Which means he's not telling the truth.
And why would he lie? Because just to protect himself.
Yeah. And why would she lie? I mean, that's the question, Chris. Why do you assume that he's the guy?
I just want to make sure you're clear about this. You're confident of your accusation.
Look, All I know is what she said and what he said.
So why was that such a problem for him, that interaction with Elizabeth Warren?
Well, let's take those two clips you played and play them against each other. Elizabeth Warren thing is a problem because it reflects one key element of the way he interacts with women on the air. He talks over them. He dismisses them. He challenges. He's incredulous. A lot of Hillary Clinton partisans, people who supported her back in 2016, felt he was belittling and dismissive of her as well over the years, and that played into, in some ways, the idea that somehow she couldn't be a presidential figure. And he also has this rich history, not just of what he says to women off the air, but what he says on the air in terms of either dismissing their thoughts or talking about them in terms of their attractiveness. There was a Daily Show, Trevor Noah's show, put together a 2-minute collage last week of ways in which he had talked about women and their looks in sort of appreciative forms that was deeply uncomfortable. And MSNBC officials told me that played into their thinking as well this past weekend.
His colleagues seemed upset by the news last night. Steve Kornacki called him a giant. Mika Brzezinski said she agreed with that and said that Matthews will be missed. Is anyone saying today that this was the wrong move to get rid of him?
Well, Kathleen Parker's a columnist for The Washington Post, frequently been a guest on his show. She said that he and she had flirted shamelessly over the years. But, you know, as more than one person pointed out online, that was done consensually. That's an exchange between two adults who want to behave that way. There were a lot of folks who really didn't feel that Matthews had much other choice. And let's go back just briefly to one other point you raised. You played the Bernie Sanders clip. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of folks who felt that politically that Chris Matthews was out of time, even as his attitudes towards women was from a different era that even then shouldn't have been acceptable, that he didn't quite understand what was building for Bernie Sanders, who's, you know, has been such a strong presence in this campaign, much in the way that much of the press didn't understand the rise of Trump on the right in 2016, and that he needed to yield, MSNBC being a left-leaning channel, needed to yield to somebody who might understand that dynamic.
Just very briefly, David, who might replace him?
It's really not clear. You know, they've brought on some new voices, but they've also been shuffling the decks there. You know, you see somebody like Nicole Wallace has performed really well in the late afternoon slot. They could well move her up, but she's a never-Trumper conservative who's abandoned the Republican Party, hardly speaking to the left. You have other figures. Ali Velshi was just given his own show, but on weekends. David Gura was moved up. Kornacki himself. It's hard to know. MSNBC and NBC does have to do some hard thinking about how they want to accommodate the current political reality and current broadcasting needs.
St. Pierre Media correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you.
You bet.
Michael Bloomberg is on the ballot today for the first time this election cycle, and he's probably the wealthiest person ever to run for president. His fortune, $65 billion, according to Forbes magazine, which makes him the 9th richest person in the world. Bloomberg made his money with an early bet on the power of computers to transform Wall Street. As NPR's Jim Zaroli reports, it is a bet that is still paying off.
Mike Bloomberg pitches himself to voters as a successful businessman and manager. And he attributes his success to hard work.
I'm not smarter than anybody else, but I can outwork you. And my key to success for you or for anybody else is make sure you're the first one in there every day and the last one to leave.
But it wasn't just work that made Bloomberg rich. It's also a story of foresight, luck, and really, really good timing. As a young man, Bloomberg graduated from Harvard Business School and went to work at the legendary blue-chip Wall Street firm Salomon Brothers. He was something of a nerd, and he came in for a lot of teasing, says Eleanor Randolph, author of The Many Lives of Michael Bloomberg.
They loved to torture him, you know. Hey, Harvard, get me coffee. And, you know, it was like a big frat house back then.
New hires such as Bloomberg were assigned lowly tasks, and he and the other newbies were sent to the vault to tally up paper bond certificates so they could be taken to the bank. They made the best of it.
They would strip down to their shorts, and they would drink beer and count bonds, and that's how he started at Salomon Brothers.
But Bloomberg was trained as an engineer, and he understood the power of computers. He pushed the firm to embrace the future. So he was eventually kicked upstairs to run the computer department.
It was considered a demotion. He'd been moved to essentially maintenance.
In 1981, he was fired. But Bloomberg would have the last laugh. He took his $10 million settlement and opened a company. It was the revenge of the nerd. As Bloomberg knew, bond trading was backward. To buy one, you had to go down to Wall Street to find a paper copy and look up who owned it. Morgan Downey was Bloomberg's global head of commodities and now runs a competing firm called Money.net.
Mike Bloomberg, back in the early 1980s, said, "This is ridiculous. I'm going to put all of this information in a database." And so that was kind of the first product they came out with.
What Bloomberg did would revolutionize bond trading. He created a boxy red computer called the Bloomberg Terminal.
Basically, it sped up the market, but the market became much more efficient.
And Bloomberg's grip on financial information would tighten. Today, subscribers get instant access to a vast trove of data, from stock and bond prices to more obscure information, like the location of any oil tanker in the world. Anyone could have done what Bloomberg did, but Bloomberg got there first.
It was basically the start of what's become now electronic trading.
And Bloomberg had another first. Before texting and email took off, it offered a chat service. Even today, people on Wall Street use it constantly.
And it's pretty straightforward, just a chat system, but you have to have a $25,000 a year subscription to Bloomberg to get access to this chat system.
That's right. Just logging on to Bloomberg costs almost $25,000 a year. And Bloomberg has some 325,000 customers, hedge fund executives and stock traders and CFOs. Some banks have hundreds of subscriptions. They bring in revenue of $10 billion a year. Bloomberg himself no longer actively manages the company, but he still owns 88%. So it's no wonder that Bloomberg considers getting fired from Salomon Brothers a lucky break.
It's the best thing that ever happened to me. And of all the people on the executive committee that fired me, sadly, one is no longer alive. But the other six are all paying customers. So
today, Bloomberg is using a chunk of his fortune to run for president, and he's vastly outspending every other candidate. But even if he fails, he'll still have many billions of dollars left over. Jim Zeroli, NPR News, New York.
Hi, this is Felix Contreras from NPR Music's Alt Latino podcast. As part of our Black History Month coverage, we take a look at the Afro-Latin roots of reggaeton and its rise over the last decade to become one of the most listened to musical genres on the planet. To check it out, download Alt Latino from wherever you get your podcasts.
The Federal Reserve announced a surprise emergency interest rate cut of a half percentage point today, the first time a cut like this has been made since the financial crisis in 2008. It is an attempt to support the economy and stabilize the volatile stock market, which has been reacting to the economic threat of the coronavirus outbreak. Joining us now is Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Hello, Jeremy.
So, interestingly, we spoke yesterday with former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers about the Fed cutting interest rates, and he said the odds are even or better that we'll go into a recession within the next year. Listen.
To start with, starting with interest rates near zero, any recession would have been hard to combat. And a recession that's induced by the fact that people are afraid to gather together in crowds is going to be a recession that's much more difficult to combat with lower interest rates than normal recessions.
So why do you think the Fed decided to cut interest rates, which were already very low?
Yeah, I mean, even with the economy, our economy at full employment and the stock market, which, you know, Jeremy, just weeks ago it hit a record, this is the kind of exogenous shock that just has the potential to shut down the entire global economy from travel, supply chains, delays in projects. And so if you're the Federal Reserve, you have only so many tools and they're kind of blunt instruments. And they conceded in their statement this morning as much, but it still had to telegraph its willingness to the world to act and act boldly.
But the markets did not react well. At some point today, they were down 700 points. The Dow was. Do you think an interest rate cut is going to be the kind of thing that could bolster the economy in the face of the coronavirus threat?
In theory, it should stoke animal spirits. You want to buy stocks. You want to make investments, get out of cash. You see the 10-year treasury now at 1%. I mean, this is called the pain trade. They're trying to smoke you out of cash. get you to spend. I mean, at what point are airlines going to offer 2-for-1 rates? You're going to see just the $5 foot long thing reemerge again. You know, suddenly it's going to be 2 $5 foot longs. Anyway, I digress. But that's all in the interest of stimulus. And of course, this goes up against the big unknown of coronavirus. We have the parallel of SARS in 2003, but that didn't jump the pond as much as this did.
You mentioned the 10-year going down to about 1%. That is probably going to trickle into mortgage markets, car loans. You know, is this going to be the kind of thing that gets people to go out and spend more money, not just Wall Street investors?
Well, it can make it more appealing on the margin to invest, to buy something, to whether it be capital or investments. But again, you've never seen this kind of dual headline track play out. After such an otherwise extraordinary move this morning, the market pulled back. So what's next? There's so far 90,000 cases across 77 countries and territories. Are we just waiting for it to spread across the U.S.? Are there other shoes that are going to drop? Central bank liquidity can only do so much. It's not going to kill this virus or invent a vaccine.
Well, and it's not going to get people to decide that they want to go to a convention that they didn't want to go to because of the coronavirus, or that they want to get on a plane and fly to a business meeting somewhere.
That's right. And that's where we're kind of beholden to science. How quickly can big pharma and countries coordinate both with quarantines and a vaccine or something to telegraph to the world that this is finally under control?
Well, and the G7 countries, the financial leaders, met today. They wanted to coordinate some kind of response. And so far, no concrete policies from them. So we'll stay tuned for that. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thank you.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
The Supreme Court hears arguments tomorrow in a case that has the potential to impact abortion access across the country. It is the first time the court will look at the issue with two new conservative justices on the bench. Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and the law for Slate. She also hosts the podcast Amicus. Dahlia, welcome back.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Sure. And what do we need to know about the law at the center of this case from Louisiana that requires doctors who perform abortions to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals?
Probably the most important thing to know is that it is identical to the Texas law, the admitting privileges law in Texas, that was struck down in 2016 when the court heard the Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt case. It's a requirement that requires any doctor who's performing an abortion to have admitting privileges at a hospital within a 30-mile radius. In Whole Women's Health, the court found that that did not benefit women's health outcomes, didn't benefit actually anyone. All it did was shutter clinics. The court's going to take a run at it, the same question.
Okay, so why? Because as you said, 2016, Texas, the court struck down that law. It's exactly the same as Louisiana, as this one in Louisiana. What, the major difference being the makeup of the court?
I think if you had to ask the question in grand constitutional terms, I think your answer is the right one, that Anthony Kennedy has since been replaced by Brett Kavanaugh. And there is a sense, at least in Louisiana and Trump's Justice Department, who are supporting them, that now the time is ripe to get a different conclusion today than the court gave in 2016.
Okay. So any signal on how the new justices, Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, lean on this issue and what role the Chief Justice John Roberts might play?
Well, that's really the essential question. I think that it's safe to say that both Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Gorsuch are going to be on the side of Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito, tending to want to allow these kinds of laws, these so-called trap measures, that we just will just have the effect of closing down clinics. And that's why all eyes currently are on the Chief Justice. He has historically been very, very willing to uphold these kinds of abortion regulations. But he's also, as we often say, an institutionalist who cares a lot about the reputational and dignitary interests of the court. And so the mere optics of flipping on a case only a few years after the court resoundingly struck down the same exact provision, it might stick in his craw in a way that suggests that he might be opening to doing some kind of fine splitting of the salami here so that he doesn't have to overtly say that the case that was decided exactly on exactly the same issues just years ago was somehow wrong.
Because precedent is supposed to mean something when it comes to the Supreme Court. If they uphold the law, it would not overturn Roe v. Wade, the law that ruling that legalized abortion nationwide with some restrictions. But what do you think the impact would be across the country?
Well, I think immediately if they uphold the law, there's going to be some effort to cabin whole women's health, to say that the undue burden that the Texas law created, using the parlance of the court's doctrine, is only actually apparently the case in Texas, and that other states can go ahead and pass these kinds of laws that will have the effect of shutting down clinics, of making, as we see in Louisiana, we'll go from 3 clinics to 1. There may be only 1 abortion provider in the state to provide abortions for 10,000 women per year who seek them. So I think the effects could be we're not overturning Roe. We're going to make it all but impossible in states that seek to regulate abortion clinics out of existence we'll make it possible for that to happen. There's a side issue in this case that's really essential that doesn't get all the attention it needs, and that is that the court is going to look at this question of third-party standing, whether abortion clinics can bring these cases on behalf of pregnant women. That has been the law, that they can do that since 1976. There's some question as to whether one way the court gets around the merits of the case by simply saying from here on in, abortion doctors, clinics can no longer represent the interests of the women they serve.
We just have a few minutes left, but I do want to ask you about another announcement from the court yesterday that it's going to hear a challenge to the Affordable Care Act. This will be the third time that the ACA goes before the court. What's this about?
This is a lawsuit that was brought by 20 Republican-run states. They're challenging the ACA on its face and saying essentially in 2017, when Congress zeroed out the penalty for failing to buy health insurance, what they meant to do was kill the entire individual mandate and, in effect, gut the entire ACA. They found a court in Texas who was willing to bless that argument. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals narrowed it somewhat but was okay with it. The court has now agreed to, in effect, say we're going to determine whether the entirety of the Affordable Care Act is, in fact, unconstitutional. And they appear to be willing to do it right before the 2020 election.
So let's talk about the timing here. The case will be on the docket this fall but not ruled on until after the election. Why is that important?
Well, we don't even know yet whether they're going to hear it in October or before the 2020 election. They're going to hear it after. But you're quite right. We won't have a decision until long after the election. It's important because I think 20 million Americans stand to lose their health coverage if the court strikes down all of the Affordable Care Act. We know that folks went to the polls in 2018. Their number one concern was their access to affordable health insurance. So it simply injects this issue front and center into the court's docket right before the presidential election. If people are worried about their access to health care, now the court is going to be a voting issue for them too.
And you know that people will be watching John Roberts again closely in this case. He has rejected challenges to the law in the past. But do you think this is going to be the final say on the ACA?
I think that John Roberts, as we just said in the abortion context, first and foremost does not want American voters to go to the polls in November of 2020 thinking about the fact that there's an 87-year-old and an 81-year-old liberal justice who can be replaced. He wants the court to fade out. So I think he will do whatever he has to do to take down the temperature on this case and on the abortion case and the other cases so that we're thinking about it after the election, not before.
Dahlia Lithwick writes about the court for Slate. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Peter, you realize this means that this could be the 6th election where the Affordable Care Act is one of the central issues.
Maybe one day we'll have an answer.
Well, let's check in quickly on Tennessee, one of the 14 states voting today for Super Tuesday, but also dealing with the aftermath of at least 2 tornadoes that struck the middle part of the state, one of which blew through Nashville, causing dozens of buildings to collapse. State emergency officials say at least 20 people were killed. Sergio Martinez Beltran is a reporter at WPLN, Nashville Public Radio. Sergio, what is the extent of the damage?
Well, the whole Middle Tennessee area is in recovery mode at this point. We're still assessing the damages of the deadly tornado. You know, this tornado tore through 4 counties, and we have a lot of destruction in some of the Nashville neighborhoods. I was in the Germantown area earlier, which is close to downtown. A lot of buildings are on the ground. I've talked to some of the evacuees, and, you know, they told me stories of how they were running down the hallway when the walls were collapsing on them. It was very scary to hear that.
Was there much warning?
You know, there was warning at the moment, but it was not something like meteorologists were saying, hey, you should expect a tornado tonight at midnight. You know, we were not expecting that, and that was not discussed. Of course, there were the alarms at the moment, but not beforehand.
How is that affecting the voting today that's going on in the Tennessee primary?
Polling locations open a bit later this morning just because of the, you know, tornadoes. And they're going to stay open until 7 p.m. So that's later than usual. And we have some polling locations that, you know, they're just not opening today. So the Secretary of State has assigned specific locations for people to go.
And in terms of how much campaigning has been going on there, have you seen a lot of the candidates in recent weeks?
Yeah, so we've had New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. He's come to Tennessee the most. But we've also seen Pete Buttigieg before he dropped out. We also saw Senator Amy Klobuchar before dropping out. And some of the candidates have sent surrogates, like Bernie Sanders. He sent his wife, Jane Sanders. And we also saw Dr. Joe Biden.
Well, we will be watching to see what happens tonight politically and, of course, in the aftermath of the tornadoes. Sergio Martinez Beltran at WPLN in Nashville, thank you.
Thank you.
Alaska's Bristol Bay is the sockeye salmon capital of the world. Much of the huge fishing fleet there is based 2,000 miles away in Washington state. But a proposed copper mine in Alaska could change all that. A long fight over the mine has torn communities apart, pitting one of the world's most valuable fisheries against what could become one of the world's biggest mines. KUOW's John Ryan reports.
The Pacific Marine Expo in Seattle is the annual trade show for the fishing industry on the West Coast. Acres of booths for boats, sonar systems, life rafts, anything to do with commercial fishing. And this year, that means there was a lot of talk about a mine.
Back in this pit will continue to generate acid mine drainage for centuries and millennia into the future.
A six-member panel spoke about and mostly railed against the Pebble Mine in southwestern Alaska. It's an area with large mineral deposits, including copper and gold. Pebble's possible impact on water and salmon has troubled the fishing industry for more than 20 years.
There are quite a few of us, especially from Washington, that spent our summers in Bristol Bay.
Elma Burnham of Bellingham was in the audience. She and a few thousand other people head up from Washington State and Oregon to Bristol Bay each summer. They work on the boats and in the canneries that handle sockeye.
It's a big part of my income, just because Bellingham isn't known for paying high salaries.
Bellingham gill netter M.J. Jackson also makes his living fishing Bristol Bay. So do his two sons.
2018, the biggest run ever in the history of Bristol Bay since recorded history. Ever.
Salmon runs in much of the world are in dire straits, but they're booming in Bristol Bay. 5 years in a row now, more than 50 million sockeye salmon have returned to Bristol Bay.
We are the largest sockeye producer in the world because we have a pristine habitat. This is a treasure. The world should care because there are no more places like Bristol Bay.
I'm sitting on the banks of the Little Togiak River, surrounded by big Alaskan mountains and lakes. That splashing you hear is countless sockeye salmon swimming upstream to spawn. The rivers and lakes here in the Bristol Bay area are factories for sockeye. Half of all the sockeye salmon caught in the world are produced right here. Bristol Bay's natural wealth hasn't always meant wealth for its people.
These communities exist in what is potentially the richest fishing grounds in the world for salmon, yet they are dying or have died. To me, that's failure.
Brad Anguson is an executive with the Alaska Peninsula Corporation. It's a native corporation owned by shareholders from five Bristol Bay villages. Anguson explains that the fishery collapsed in the 90s, forcing many locals to sell their valuable commercial fishing permits.
All of those permits went to people who live down in Washington and, well, generally outside of the region and even the state.
Now, more than half the catch in Bristol Bay is caught by people from outside Alaska. That's left some locals hoping that a big mine can turn their fortunes around. Anguson's native corporation signed a deal to work with Pebble.
If our villages were healthy and sustainable and they had commerce, would we be in this position right now? Probably not.
If you take a small plane across the rugged, roadless expanse southwest of Anchorage, after about 100 miles, you'll hit Alaska's biggest lake, Lake Iliamna. From the lakefront village of Iliamna, it's a short helicopter ride to the Pebble Mine site. Larry Hill is a retired schoolteacher in Iliamna. He also spent a decade working as a bear guard for the Pebble Project.
This is a dumb question. What's a bear guard?
Well, gee. We have a lot of bears in the area, and the management was worried about getting mauled or the bears getting killed.
So the mining company hired locals as armed guards for the consultants doing preliminary field work. Even though he's worked for Pebble, Hill says he's torn about the mine project.
Keeps me awake at night. It could be the worst-case scenario, or it could be the best thing for our area.
He's worried about what'll happen to salmon and other native foods if there's a spill of toxic mine waste. But he's also worried about Iliamna without the mine. His three grandsons have all moved away.
There are very few jobs here. I'm worried that our villages are going to just kind of dry up and go away.
Hill says the issue has divided families and friends.
People are kind of emotional about this because you feel deeply for the land. And I have some friends that just understood we don't discuss the Pebble Project.
Bristol Bay natives farther downstream tend to have a more negative view of the Pebble Project.
It threatens to take away all that we enjoy, the salmon, our pristine waters.
Alexana Salmon is the head of the Igiagig Village Council. In this isolated village, wild foods like salmon and caribou remain essential.
We have a right to maintain this ancient connection to our homelands. We've given up so much already. I feel like we've been pushed to the limits because we will feel the impacts on a disproportionate level than anyone else.
I appreciate that Alexana and others' fears are real, but I do not believe that they're based in science.
Pebble CEO Tom Collier stands to make a $12 million bonus if the mine is approved by next year. He says the mine poses no risk to the Bristol Bay fishery, and the Army Corps of Engineers agrees, but its conclusion comes from studies conducted by the mining company. University of Washington biologist Dan Schindler stands on the shores of Lake Nurka, where he has spent the past 23 summers studying this ecosystem, and more recently poring over environmental impact studies for the mine. He calls the industry-funded claim that the mine won't harm fish downstream
patently false. I think it's our obligation to advocate for credible science.
The Army Corps expects to issue a final decision later this year. Whatever the decision, lawsuits are expected. For Here and Now, I'm John Ryan.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.